Hi, Marco Werman here with a quick reminder before the show. Right now we're fundraising for the world with a goal of raising $100,000. Yeah, we know that is a big number, but when you're creating a show with the in-depth human-centered reporting that you rely on, there are big expenses, and that's where we need your help. Our coverage is part of how you make sense of current events. You listen to this podcast to feel connected. It's part of your day. So please donate at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Do it today. And now, the show. The globe needs to get off of fossil fuels, but some countries in Africa that are prospecting for oil say digging up their natural resources is needed for economic growth.
Why should the pressure to stop oil and gas be for projects in countries that have not yet reached a certain level of development?
Also today, in India, trying to shift some of the responsibility in planning for a pregnancy off of women.
All of this falls on women. There is much to be done to bring in men to talk about these things.
And Uruguay's Jorge Drexler, the singer-songwriter, is up for 9 Latin Grammys tonight. He says composing during the pandemic, surprisingly hard.
I need to play it or say it to another human being. It's strange. I didn't know I needed that.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. 8 years ago, flight MH17 took off from Amsterdam, bound for Kuala Lumpur. It never made it. The Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777 was shot down over Ukraine. Today, in a courthouse near Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport,
all rise.
A verdict in the case over who shot the plane down. A Dutch judge found 2 Russians and 1 Ukrainian man guilty in absentia and sentenced them to life in jail. For more on what the verdict means and what's left unresolved, we have Arik Toller on the line. He's a reporter and researcher for Bellingcat, the research team that originally linked the flight's destruction to Russian-backed forces in eastern Ukraine. Arik, who are the men who were convicted today?
Yeah, so there's 3 people who were convicted. Sergei Dubinsky, Igor Gergen, and a guy named Harchenko, too. So these are 3 men who were linked to the so-called Donetsk People's Republic, which is the Russian-backed proxy forces, who were in charge of the military apparatus at the time, and who either directly or indirectly commanded the missile launcher and the murder weapon that killed 298 people.
One man escaped conviction. Who is he?
Yeah, a guy named Oleg Pulatov. He escaped conviction, more of a technicality, I guess you could say. He was involved in the downing. He wasn't a big fish. He wasn't really a decision maker. And so he basically got off because he just didn't quite cross the culpability under Dutch law to be convicted.
Arik, you've been involved in this story for a long time. What do you think this means to the international families of the 298 people killed on board MH17?
I'm sure it's tremendous to have some sort of closure, but of course it's not real closure because these men will never, unless something crazy happens, they're never going to face real justice. They're going to be in Ukraine/Russia the rest of their lives. They're never going to see The Hague unless they are captured, or there's some crazy regime change in Russia, someday down the line. But I think the more important thing is the Dutch-led joint investigation team, which handled the criminal trial. They were incredibly exhaustive in their work and of the research that they publicly made, showing the exact timeline of what happened, who was responsible for what, phone calls between the commanders and organizing the transport and the exfiltration of this missile launcher back to Russia.
Aside from those families not seeing these convicted defendants going to jail, what remains unresolved in this case?
So the people who were convicted today, the 3, they were kind of the low-hanging fruit, I would say. These are the people who were in phone calls, speaking on the telephone and publicly discussing their involvement in the downing. Because the Ukrainian security services have access to the telecom networks, and they were releasing, left and right, the phone calls between these people in the lead up to the downing and also in the panic afterwards. The real people that matter are on the other side of the border. The military leadership back in Russia that was overlooking them, which of course goes to Shoigu, the defense minister, Putin, if you want to go that high, but also kind of the regional commanders who were who made the decision to send this missile launcher to Ukraine from Moscow or from regional headquarters offices.
With Russia's war now in Ukraine, a lot of observers are looking at this 2014 episode and the deaths resulting from the plane being shot down and saying MH17 should have been a clear warning sign. Do you think this was a missed opportunity for the West to confront Russia and Vladimir Putin?
looking back, I mean, it's about as flagrant as you can get. I mean, the actual Russian servicemen like went to Ukraine and they shot down a passenger plane. They denied it. They still deny it. And, you know, there were sanctions after this happened. There were consequences. But looking back, they're pretty light.
Arik Toler is the director of training and research at Bellingcat, which originally linked the downing of MH17 to Russian-backed separatists in Ukraine. A judge in the Netherlands today handed down in absentia guilty verdicts for three defendants in that case. Arik, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
The Russian military has been steadily losing ground in Ukraine for months, despite the Kremlin's mobilization of tens of thousands of new recruits for the war. Moscow is also getting help from abroad. Iran is supplying Russia with drones. According to Western officials, the Iranian government is also providing ballistic missiles. Now there are reports that Russia is getting assistance from North Korea. The World's Daniel Offman has been looking into that.
North Korea is providing Russia with artillery shells, rockets, and winter military uniforms. That's according to recent news reports, but both governments deny it. Here's State Department spokesperson Ned Price earlier this month speaking about North Korea.
We have information that despite the public denials that we've heard from the DPRK, the DPRK is covertly supplying Russia's war in Ukraine with a significant number of artillery shells.
Russia's relationship with the country goes back decades. Here's Professor Sung-Yoon Lee. He teaches Korean politics and foreign relations at the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
The role of the Soviet Union, formerly the Soviet Union and Russia, this is crucial to the history of the despotic dynasty known as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
Kim Il-sung. Среди ветеранов антияпонской революции.
This is from a Soviet documentary glorifying Kim Il-sung, the founder of the North Korean state. Kim was an officer in the Soviet army.
Ветеранами антияпонской революции.
After World War II, Joseph Stalin chose Kim as the leader of North Korea and supported his decision to invade South Korea in 1950.
The Soviet Union became thereafter North Korea's most important supporter, militarily, politically, and perhaps most importantly, economically, throughout the Cold War.
That relationship wasn't always smooth. And with the fall of the Soviet Union, things between Russia and North Korea cooled down a lot. But a decade later, that changed.
In the aftermath of the ascendance of a man named Vladimir Putin in 1999-2000, Putin became the first top leader of either the Soviet Union or Russia to visit North Korea.
And in Pyongyang, they rolled out the red carpet for Putin. In this segment, a North Korean state TV, crowds at the airport cheered and waved Russian and North Korean flags. Sung-Yoon Lee says this was the start of a new era of warmer relations between Russia and North Korea.
When it comes to security matters, the two nations have always been partners. And with Putin's dreadful war in Ukraine, the old dynamics of the Cold War, Russia, China, North Korea on one side, and the United States, South Korea, and Japan on the other side, this Cold War rift has come back.
Lee says it makes sense for Kim Il-sung's grandson, Kim Jong-un, to be supplying Russia with military equipment. Fyodor Tertitsky agrees. He's a researcher at Kumin University in South Korea, where he studies the North Korean military. Tertitsky says that Russia has used up a lot of its modern equipment in Ukraine, and they're now using older artillery and tanks.
For that, you need ammunition, and the North Korean military uses a lot of Soviet equipment, and North Korea can supply exactly this kind of ammunition which might have been provided to them by the USSR, ironically.
Tertitsky says North Korea needs the cash. It needs oil, food, and humanitarian assistance from Russia as well. And the country's in a good position to provide military hardware.
North Korea is very a military industry-oriented country. They have a particular term they call second industry. So the first industry is like civilian one, the second one is a military one, sort of implying they're a bit of equal.
Tertitsky says there's reason to be skeptical here because there hasn't been a smoking gun or concrete evidence that North Korea is supplying Russia with lots of weapons. But he says the fact that these reports are so believable says something about the state of Russia's military and its war in Ukraine. For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
Britain is in recession. That was the gloomy prognosis today from the country's chancellor, Jeremy Hunt. He laid out details of the government's first budget plan under new Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. The tough budget measures are seen as a test for the new British leader. Remember that Sunak is Britain's third Prime Minister this year alone. For more on this, our Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins us from London. Orla, the last time Britain announced its budget plans, that was actually only a couple of months ago, it sent the financial markets into chaos. What was the reaction in Britain today?
Yeah, this was a very different financial plan from the mini budget of Liz Truss's government, which caused such chaos, as you say, and effectively brought down her leadership. So far today, in terms of the markets, they haven't actually moved that much. The pound did drop a little, but nothing like the reaction we saw a few months ago. And Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, talked today about delivering stability, stability, stability for Britain, which I imagine was language that he was specifically directing at those markets. He also talked a lot about the British economy being in bad shape, because it really is. And what he didn't say was that any of this was the fault of Liz Truss's government or her financial proposals, or in fact the past 12 years that his party has been in power in Britain.
The Office for Budget Responsibility confirms global factors are the primary cause of current inflation.
The opposition parties weren't buying any of that. Have a listen to the response from Rachel Reeves. She's lawmaker with the opposition Labour Party.
The mess we are in, the mess we are in, is the result of 12 weeks of Conservative chaos, but also 12 years of Conservative economic failure.
All right. So when we say the economy is in bad shape, Orla, just how badly is the economy in Britain doing right now? And will this new fiscal plan do anything to ease it?
Yeah, it's not good. For months we've been hearing Britain is heading into recession. This morning, just as the Chancellor was announcing his new budget, the government's own independent analyst, the Office for Budget Responsibility, said officially the UK is in recession. Not only that, but that living standards are falling by the largest amount in 70 years in Britain right now. And this is...
Wow.
Yeah, it's actually the biggest takeaway of the day, as opposed to the budget. This is the issue that everyone is talking about. Jeremy Hunt says that he's hoping that his budget, which includes billions of dollars in spending cuts and tax rises, that'll go some way to balancing the books. But the reality is millions of people are going to be paying more in tax. I should say anyone that I spoke to today, they've already been belt tightening for months. You know, many people haven't turned their heating on yet. It is November. It is... Still, you know, it's not too bad in terms of how British winters can be. It's chilly and it's gloomy and it's rainy. It's the kind of time that you do switch on the heating just to sort of curl up against the elements. But lots of people that I was talking to today just said that they have been holding off because energy bills are just so high.
Finally, Orla, this is the first budget under Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Has there been any discussion on what all this says about him?
Yeah, our understanding is that Rishi Sunak was very closely involved in drawing up the budget. And one of the big changes in this budget from Liz Truss's one is that the highest earners in the UK are now going to have to pay more tax. And this will certainly go down well with the overall population, because Liz Truss, if you might remember, lowered the tax rate for people earning over $180,000. And that just infuriated the general public. So Jeremy Hunt has sort of upended all of that. Also, some of the big public spending cuts that they've announced will actually not take effect for another couple of years. And the hope is that the inflation will have eased by then and maybe Britain will have pulled out of a recession, so the cuts won't be felt as harshly. But a slightly more cynical take is that Rishi Sunak's government could be delaying those cuts for 2 years, because by then it's quite likely another government or even a Labour government will be in office. So it may well be another Chancellor and another Prime Minister that will have to deal with the effect of those cuts that were announced today.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Thank you very much, Orla.
You're welcome, Marco.
The Latin Grammys are tonight. We hear from superstar nominee Jorge Drexler just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Cambodia sent one of its top government officials to the World Wildlife Conference, now underway in Panama. That's a global gathering with leaders from around the world where they periodically update laws that protect endangered animals. The Cambodian official never showed up. While transiting through New York's JFK airport, he was arrested for allegedly running an international monkey smuggling ring. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following the story from Bangkok. Patrick, who is this official and what are the charges?
So his name is Maspal Kree. He is Cambodia's number two top-ranking wildlife official. And according to U.S. prosecutors, he facilitated this whole operation that would go into the jungles of Cambodia and poach endangered monkeys, specifically the long-tailed macaque, which is this kind of smallish monkey with very heavy eyelids and a little pink face. And this operation would then sell the monkeys to a company that breeds primates with the intent of selling them. Now, this is totally legal. You can breed primates on farms and sell them, but they would conceal the wild-caught monkeys with the captive-bred monkeys and conceal their origins, and then sell them to buyers in the United States who thought that they were buying monkeys raised on farms. With the right permit, you can do that, but of course, you can't buy wild, endangered monkeys. So, Marco, if the charges are accurate, this was a pretty lucrative racket for this official. They sent at least 3,000 macaques to the U.S. over a series of years, and just one shipment of a couple hundred monkeys is worth about $1 million.
Wow. So help us understand why smugglers would want to bring monkeys into the U.S. What's the market here all about for monkeys?
So this type of macaque is ideal for toxicity testing and pharmaceutical trials. The U.S. has a lot of these pharmaceutical trials that test drugs on primates, specifically this long-tailed macaque. China was the biggest supplier of this primate, but their border shut because of the COVID pandemic, and then Cambodia shot to the top, becoming the number one supplier.
So this official who's supposed to be protecting these macaque monkeys, allegedly, kind of the fox acting like an ally guarding the henhouse. What's next? How will this episode affect Cambodia's reputation for protecting wildlife?
Yeah, this arrest is very humiliating for the wildlife department in Cambodia. This man's colleagues are still at this World Wildlife Conference, which he was en route to. It's in Panama. He faces, the official, Mr. Kree, he faces more than 140 years in prison. But the U.S. Justice Department is also charging his boss, the number one Cambodian wildlife official. He is presumably still in Cambodia, and so now the U.S. has to try to extradite him. If they are successful, he faces up to 100 years as well. So far, Marco, the Cambodian government has not responded about this at all.
The World Southeast Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen. Good to speak with you, Patrick. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Jorge Drexler won an Academy Award back in 2005 for his work on the soundtrack to The Motorcycle Diaries. The singer and songwriter from Uruguay is back in the limelight. After 5 years of not recording, Drexler's new album has received 9 Latin Grammy nominations, and tonight he'll perform at the awards ceremony in Las Vegas. Here's more from the world's TV Zaya.
Corría la era del mesoproterozoico, cuando aquella célula visionaria.
Like a lot of artists and musicians, Jorge Drexler used his time during the pandemic to get creative. That's when he wrote the songs for this new album. It's full of collaborations with singers like Rubén Blades from Panama.
Fundirse los dos en una, buscar en otro cobijo. Crear la palabra hijo barajando la fortuna.
But Drexler says it wasn't easy coming up with new songs during a time of complete isolation.
The pandemic was very hard on everybody. I guess it affected differently every personality. I myself found it very, very difficult, especially to finish the songs.
He says he discovered something about himself. He likes writing in isolation, but only up to a certain point. Because when he's got the first draft of a new song,
I need to play it or say it to another human being. At least needed to feel the presence of another person to whom direct that writing. It's strange. I didn't know I needed that.
This is the title track of the album Tinta y Tiempo, or Ink and Time.
It's like it's kind of a prayer.
A prayer for creative inspiration to finally finish writing his songs.
Tinta y tiempo, tinta y tiempo,
when I find myself in that writer's block, I try to relax and think that, you know, what has to be written will be written in the end. Just let the ink and the time do the work in the blank page.
Drexler says that's why the cover of the new album is completely white.
The blank page, it's a promise of possibilities. Everything can fall into a blank page. But of course, for every battle that you win against the blank page, I mean, every finished song you have, I have at least 10 unfinished verses or 10 unfinished songs that won't see the light of day. So I paid homage to the blank page.
Living in Madrid during periods of lockdown wasn't easy, he says. But that also inspired him to expand his horizons and try different styles. In the song O Algoritmo, he teams up with Israeli rapper Noga Erez. I'm on the top of the roof and I feel like a jailer.
Rather not pay the bail. It's a dangerous... We met in social media. She said, I love your music, let's collab. And I said, okay, what about Tuesday? We were in the middle of the pandemics, and we met for a Zoom meeting, and I had this idea of a chorus saying, who wants me to want what I believe that I want? Tell me what I have to sing, oh mighty algorithm. I know that you know it better than I do.
He says the song reflects on the concept of free will.
We talk a lot about freedom, but many, many times we prefer to let somebody else or something else make the decisions for you. They might be politicians or they might be algorithms.
Drexler was trained as a doctor, but after studying medicine for 10 years, he realized he wanted to dedicate his life to music. 30 years and many successes later, he says he's changed a lot.
As you evolve as a human being, your songs also evolve with you, and things that were right at some point of your life become wrong at some other point of your life, and you will find songs that contradict one another, like periods of my life that contradict one another.
I asked what he thinks now about the Jorge Drexler of 30 years ago.
I would tell the Jorge of 1992 not to listen to Jorge's 2022 advice. I mean, just follow the way, make every mistake, you have to find your way. En la duerme vela, el corazón
espera, sin saber muy bien a qué. For the world, I'm Divisay Sea. Busca en las rendijas, mueve las clavijas,
desafinándose. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. A grand experiment is going on in South Africa. Wealthy nations are loaning the country money to transition away from coal and toward renewables. A necessary step to fight climate change, but it's happening very fast.
And it sort of feels like these renewables are being shoved down our throats whether we like it or not.
South Africa's rapid energy transition, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Delegates at the United Nations Climate Conference in Egypt have been tackling a big question. Should they pledge to phase out the use of all fossil fuels? It's not clear yet if that goal will appear in the summit's final agreement. Many African countries might support the long-term aspirations. They also have shorter-term economic ambitions. For example, many governments on the continent are looking to take advantage of new fossil fuel possibilities in their own backyards. The world's Halima Gikandi recently traveled to Uganda in East Africa, where a new oil pipeline is in the works.
In the far ends of western Uganda, surrounded by lush green farms, is the city of Hoima. Recently, Hoima has come to be known as Uganda's oil city. 22-year-old Nicholas Ahebwa sells women's bags and jewelry at a market here.
It's called oil city because once upon a time, there is a mineral called oil which was discovered in this region. Then when they were naming it, they had to name it Oil City because it is It's the only region which has oil.
Commercial quantities of oil were discovered in this part of Uganda back in 2006. The government says there are 6.5 billion barrels of oil under the ground, of which around 1.4 billion can be recovered. Now the Ugandan government is seeking to develop and refine that oil in partnership with Total, the French energy company, and a state-owned corporation from China. I ask Ahebwa if he thinks ordinary people here will see the benefits of any of that.
Yeah, people will benefit because as we say right now, we talk, even roads are being constructed, markets, that means people, employment will increase. People will benefit directly, others will benefit indirectly. Even people from outside Hoima will also benefit Uganda at large.
That's the hope, at least. The Ugandan government is banking on these prospects of employment and development as they promote this oil project. Gloria Sibikari is with the Petroleum Authority of Uganda, which regulates the oil and gas sector here.
One of the key benefits when we start production is the revenue that will come in. We estimate that the country will be earning close to $2 billion annually. This is a significant addition to our GDP.
She says that revenue can go towards building new infrastructure like hospitals and schools. It will also help boost Uganda's energy security.
So Uganda plans to construct a 60,000 barrels per day refinery in Hoima to produce petroleum products like petrol, diesel, jet fuel and the like to be consumed in the Ugandan market.
The plan is also to export oil abroad through a new pipeline called the East African Crude Oil Pipeline, or ECOP. It will run more than 890 miles from here in western Uganda to a port in neighboring Tanzania. Driving outside the city of Hoima, I see how this pipeline project is already transforming this part of the country. There are smooth new roads and a new international airport in the works, too. But the oil project has also brought concerns about the environmental and social costs that come with it. In September, the European Parliament adopted a resolution condemning what they called the human rights violations and environmental dangers connected with fossil fuel projects in Uganda. Here's what President Yoweri Museveni had to say about that.
Some of these people are insufferable. You need to control yourself not to explode. So shallow, so egocentric, so wrong.
This disagreement is emblematic of a bigger showdown taking place on the continent. Many African countries are seeking to benefit from their fossil fuel discoveries, from Senegal to Mozambique. Some say Western critics scolding African governments for these types of projects are hypocritical. Gloria Sibikari of the Petroleum Authority points out how Western countries are still investing in fossil fuels.
We are not seeing a global slowdown. On the contrary, countries are picking pace. And so this begs the question, why should the pressure to stop oil and gas or to delay projects be for projects in developing countries? Countries that have not yet reached a certain level of development, and given the fact that a lot of the developing countries developed on the back of the oil and gas and other natural resources.
Sibikari says it's only fair for Uganda and other African countries to benefit too. Besides, she says, the context is very different here. Most Ugandans don't have access to clean energy or even electricity to begin with, so they rely on burning charcoal and firewood instead, which leads to deforestation. Sibikari says that's the big driver of emissions here.
So if the oil and gas sector can support a bigger part of the population to transition away from the use of charcoal and wood fuel into use of gas, which is much cleaner than wood fuel, then we are contributing to the fight against climate change. We are reducing our emissions as a country.
Sibikari explains that cooking gas will be a byproduct of this oil project. Already, the Ministry of Energy has been giving canisters of cooking gas to poor families for free so they can transition away from using charcoal. 37-year-old Noe Kazo lives in Busabala on the outskirts of Kampala. Before this year, she had only used charcoal or firewood for cooking. Kazo shows me the small two-burner stove that was given to her by the government. It's attached to a gas cylinder that sits in the corner. The government told us we should stop using charcoal, Kazo tells me, because the smoke is bad for us and because it's damaging our environment. Kazo tells me that now she cooks using gas on a daily basis. She says it's more efficient, faster, and cleaner than using charcoal or firewood. I still use charcoal to cook traditional foods, Kazo tells me. They just taste better that way.
Oh, which traditional foods?
Matoke.
Matoke,
okay. Matoke is like a starchy green banana that is a staple food here in Uganda. When I ask Kazo if she would buy gas with her own money in the future, she says yes, if it were cheaper. The Ugandan government argues that investments in this new oil project will make energy more affordable for everyone and help with the country's energy transition. But for some Ugandans, this massive infrastructure project is doing more harm than good. We'll hear more about that tomorrow. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Hoima, Uganda.
At the UN climate conference this week, a plan was unveiled to help Indonesia shut down its coal-fired power plants. $20 billion would come from wealthier countries like the U.S. and Japan. The UN is calling this a just transition plan to cleaner burning fuels. Indonesia will actually be the second case. South Africa was the first. The World's Anna Kusma reports.
Almost exactly a year ago, at the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow, South Africa's president Cyril Ramaphosa announced an $8.5 billion plan to shut down his country's coal plants.
This transition must also be fair and just. For many developing economies, this requires massive investment in alternative energy sources and other infrastructure.
The plan called for a big leap towards a renewables-based economy.
But our ability to do so will be determined by the extent of support that we receive from developed economies.
In this case, the US, the UK, Germany, France, and the EU. Here's EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen at the announcement last year.
I hope it will be a blueprint for similar partnerships with other countries.
Right now, South Africa gets around 85% of its electricity from aging coal-fired power plants. Transitioning to renewables is a huge task, says Leo Roberts, a researcher at the energy transition think tank E3G.
So South Africa needs to close coal and build renewables, and it needs to support miners in the mining communities.
The real price tag of all this is closer to $1 trillion. Robert says the goal is for the initial $8.5 billion to eventually attract more outside investment. That's the idea, at least.
There is now this question about whether there is enough money going into South Africa to actually leverage the tens of billions of private money that's actually needed.
It took almost a year for South Africa's government to release a more detailed plan. It says aging coal plants will be retired in 3 decades, and the country will invest in electric vehicle manufacturing and community-owned solar energy. One detail stood out to South Africans. Almost all the initial money, 97%, is loans that South Africa will need to pay back. On national TV, Daniel Minele, the head of South Africa's climate finance team, was pressed on this by reporter Hugo Ribatika.
It's almost unfair, don't you think, Mr. Minele, that the West, who is loaning us this money, is primarily the cause of global warming. I mean, we contribute less than 4% to the effects of climate change, and then we have to borrow these huge, huge sums.
Look, I think a fair point that you're making in terms of...
He says leaders will continue to negotiate for better terms.
While the offer at the moment and what's on the table generally is insufficient, that's something, though, to start with.
South African energy economist Lungile Mashele is less generous in her reading. Only about half of the loans are concessional, meaning below market rate. The rest are commercial loans and investment guarantees.
South Africa is being used as a poster child for this transition. It would be prudent to give us more grant funding, find ways to make the money either extremely cheap or even free.
South Africa is already in massive debt and dealing with daily blackouts from an energy crisis. Mashele says she supports an energy transition, but argues the current plan moves faster than the economy can handle.
It sort of feels like that these renewables are being shoved down our throats, whether we like it or not.
Mashele says she wants to see a better deal for South Africa and for other countries like Indonesia to learn from what's happened. Sandeep Pai is watching this closely. He's an energy transition expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
I would advise Indonesia to not rush into this. Otherwise, you will hear all these top headlines at this COP, you know, historic agreement between Indonesia and G7 on phasing out coal. But then 1 year down the line, you will have same issues.
From COP27 in Egypt, Salim Fakir tells me he has some reservations, but he's really excited by what he sees as a first step. Fakir is the director of the African Climate Foundation.
I think the approach is profound. It is already attracting huge interest. I think it's a model that can go beyond just energy transitions, possibly into adaptation and resilience.
Since the funding was announced last year, Fakir says he's seen a lot of planning and creativity from South Africans.
It's taking from the abstract to the concrete now. I think that's the shift that we've seen. You know, there's money on the table. How do we solve these issues in a real way?
Similar just transition plans are also being discussed for Vietnam, Senegal, and India. For The World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
Myanmar's military-controlled government has thrown thousands of pro-democracy activists in jail since it took power nearly 2 years ago. Today, it vowed to release more than 700 of them. A leader of Myanmar's 1988 pro-democracy uprising is among those already set free. So are some high-profile foreign nationals, including a former British ambassador, an Australian academic, and a Japanese filmmaker. Kenneth Roth, the former executive director of Human Rights Watch, says it is a limited gesture.
From the perspective of the prisoners, it's a big deal. People who have been in prison for almost 2 years since the coup, you know, of course, it's great to have them out. But I think we have to put it in perspective. 700 political prisoners released is wonderful, but this is in the context of, you know, 16,000 people who have been detained. We don't know exactly how many remain in prison, but I think it's safe to say that there are still thousands of political prisoners. So this is, you know, a good step, but it's just a step. Political imprisonment is one issue in Myanmar, but so is the shooting of pro-democracy protesters. There have been nearly 2,500 civilians killed in the last, you know, nearly 2 years. There is an insurgency against the junta. It is responding with scorched earth tactics, you know, burning down villages, forcing massive displacement. None of that changes through these prisoner releases.
February will mark 2 years since the coup in Myanmar. Why do you think military leaders are doing this now?
Well, they have been under intense pressure. And of course, it's significant that all of the foreign prisoners have now been released, because that's a, you know, a big source of pressure from Australia, from Japan, etc. So this is clearly a hope on the part of the junta to try to dissipate international pressure. ASEAN had just met, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which many people look to as a principal source of influence over the junta. Myanmar is a member of ASEAN. They basically have been excluded from it in practical terms since the coup, but ASEAN has still been pretty weak. And undoubtedly, you know, from this most recent meeting, word got out that ASEAN was unhappy with the lack of progress. There had been a so-called five-point consensus plan reached about a year and a half ago, which has basically gone no place. You know, the junta promised to end the violence. That didn't happen. It promised to, you know, have a dialogue with all of the parties, including the National League for Democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi's party. That hasn't happened. You know, we would like to see ASEAN ratchet up the pressure. The difficulty is that ASEAN, you know, they operate by consensus. They include, you know, not only governments like Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, which have been outspoken against the junta, but also, for example, a government like Cambodia, Prime Minister Hun Sen, himself an autocrat, who this year is the chair of ASEAN, who is perfectly happy with another dictatorship.
Right. I mean, there's political pressure from ASEAN. I mean, don't the ASEAN nations also have some economic leverage over Myanmar? Why don't they use that?
Absolutely. You know, many of the Myanmar junta's foreign currency revenues come via Malaysia or via Singapore, ASEAN members. Those could be cut off. So there's no question that it has leverage. But because ASEAN has this tradition of consensus, it typically doesn't get involved in each other's business because a good half of the nations are themselves quite dictatorial. It just isn't used to dealing with so abusive, recalcitrant a member, you know, even though, given the brutality of the Myanmar junta, you know, this is an exceptional circumstance that does seem to demand some kind of action, but ASEAN still can't get its act together to really act in a meaningful way.
Ken, where does the hope lie for you as the military junta in Myanmar enters its third year in power in February?
I mean, for me, the hope lies in the fact that the junta has completely lost the people of Myanmar. It is profoundly unpopular. People are, you know, going to the streets at the risk of not only detention, but also being shot. So it's absolutely clear where the people of the country stand. Yes, the junta has the guns, although not even a monopoly on the guns, because they are facing considerable ethnic and increasingly broader insurgencies. But, you know, it is difficult for a government to hang on when it is so utterly unpopular. And so for me, that's where the hope lies. I think it's important for us to recognize that, you know, yes, this is a brutal regime, but we can stand with the people of the country. And it is difficult for a military to endlessly repress people who simply want democracy. They want a government that is accountable to them rather than a government that serves itself.
Kenneth Roth is the former executive director of Human Rights Watch. He's been speaking with us about the release of some 700 political prisoners in Myanmar. Ken, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This week, our planet crossed a big numerical threshold. There are now officially more than 8 billion people on Earth. China remains the world's most populous nation, but sometime next year, India, with its 1.4 billion people, will claim the top spot. Sushmita Pathak reports from Uttar Pradesh, the Indian state with the highest population, about the challenges and opportunities that are sure to come with even more growth.
Expecting mothers are waiting for their token number to be called out at the District Women's Hospital in Meerut, about 50 miles from India's capital, New Delhi. 32-year-old Muni Devi cradles her pregnant belly as she sits in a metal chair waiting for a routine checkup. Devi says this pregnancy was unplanned. She and her husband already have 2 kids. They didn't want any more, she says, because their financial situation is not great. She considered an abortion, but her in-laws were against it, so she's going to keep the baby. She's not taking any more chances, though. Soon after her delivery, she will undergo a tubectomy to prevent any unwanted pregnancies in the future. Women across India are thinking like Devi. They want a small family. Government data shows India's total fertility rate, which is the average number of kids per woman, has dropped to 2. In the 1950s, it was around 6. And even though India will become the most populous country next year, its population growth has actually slowed down, thanks to a decades-old government-run family planning program. Family planning commercials frequently air on TV and radio here. In the state of Uttar Pradesh, there's a government-run hotline for people seeking advice on birth control. And female health workers spread awareness about contraception in their communities. One such worker is Somvati Asar, who is accompanying Devi today. Asar goes door to door in Devi's village, advising women to have a minimum 3-year gap between births. She also distributes condoms and contraceptive pills. In her 4 years on the job, she's convinced dozens of women to get birth control procedures done. But only one man. Men think getting a vasectomy is an attack on their self-respect, she says. Another health worker tells me men refuse to even talk to her about family planning. As a result, women end up bearing the entire burden, says social scientist Kohika Seth.
The responsibility of pregnancy and anything to do with children, anything to do with reproduction, all of this falls on women. There is much to be done and much to be thought of to bring in men to talk about these things. And I think it'll be a game changer.
The shift has begun in small ways. Family planning awareness drives in rural areas, for example, used to be called mother-in-law, daughter-in-law meetups. Now, the sons are also a part of it. There's another thing that needs to change, says Andrea Vonar. She's the India representative at the UN Population Fund.
With such a large young population, the traditional method of family planning being female sterilization is not necessarily the most appropriate one.
Female sterilization is India's most common birth control method. But the country's young couples are increasingly delaying having kids. Vonar says they need access to temporary birth control measures.
And therefore, it's really important for the government to make sure that there's a full range, a full basket of family planning options.
Basket of choice. All methods are available.
A literal basket of options greets me as I enter the Family Planning Counseling Center at the hospital in Meerut. A staff member walks me through the choices.
Copper
IUDs of different durations, morning after pills, twice a week tablets, condoms, injectables. These are the types of options young Indians need going forward. There's another thing that acts like a contraceptive and plays a big role. Education.
Really making sure that girls in particular are getting a full education and getting access to the job market.
Female workforce participation in India is the lowest among emerging economies. Experts say only when that goes up will India be able to harness its youth potential. Overall, demographer K.S. James says India has a pretty good window of opportunity coming up.
Fortunately, for the coming several decades, India will have an advantage because India's bulk of the population will be the working age group.
The number of young people may be going up now, but a few decades later, so will the number of old people. And by 2050, India will have three times as many people over 60 as it does now. That will bring new challenges.
Increasing older age population and increasing disease burden. How are we able to handle and tackle them? These are all very, very important in the future years to come.
Even so, Andrea Wonar from the UNFPA says India's growing population presents an opportunity.
India has the upper hand. They have a very strong deck of cards to play in taking the population and the world forward. Really, the thing to keep in mind is where women and girls have decision-making power, where they're educated, and where they're able to exercise their reproductive rights and choices, this is where the country will succeed.
For the world, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Meerut, India.
When you're trying to get somewhere and you don't know the way, what's the first thing you do? Well, nowadays, you get out your phone and rely on Google or Waze. But what if there are no roads and a lot of icebergs are blocking your path? Johnny Smith has a new tool for you. He's a scientist with the Artificial Intelligence Lab at the British Antarctic Survey.
We wanted to develop a toolkit that the captain can use to actually determine a route between two positions, the quickest route and the most fuel efficient route.
Smith's lab's new toolkit is designed for massive polar ships.
So we have to take into account changing weather conditions. When you're in polar regions, you've got even more added complexities. You've got sea ice constantly changing. You've got icebergs.
The tool uses artificial intelligence and satellite data to evaluate ice and come up with the best path. It even incorporates weather and ocean current models to predict future conditions. So it could tell a ship's captain, for example.
You may not see it at the moment, but things are changing. That area is going to be ice-ridden, so take a wider berth around it.
Right now, the tool is being designed for research vessels that venture to the poles to study glaciers and penguins, things like that. Those kinds of ships burn a lot of fuel, says Smith, which is bad for the climate. Finding better routes could cut down emissions by 10 or even 20%.
If an icebreaker takes a wrong pathway and gets stuck in ice, it's expending fuel that doesn't actually need to be used for the experimentation side.
Get the data, get there efficiently, and cut down on emissions that are melting the ecosystems you're trying to study. Smith says it'll be a couple of years until the tool is fully functional, and eventually it could be used by captains of ships that are not only in icy waters. Solutions, always good to hear. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you again tomorrow. Marco here with a word before we go. A reminder that our fall fundraiser is happening right now. If you donate $100, you'll get a special shout out on the podcast in early 2023. And everyone who donates will be invited to a virtual party with our newsroom on January 19th. So what are you waiting for? Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you and be well.